Talk Shoe. Recorded live.
Welcome to the Customer Experience Optimization Talk Show. I'm Lynn Hunsaker, your host today, and I'm pleased to have Ingrid Lindberg, Chief Customer Officer, joining our call today. Hey, Ingrid.
Hey, Lynn.
Well, this has been an ongoing series that we've had for several months. We've covered customer experience teams, customer experience strategy, customer-centric culture, customer experience metrics, analytics, and now customer lifetime value. So if any of our listeners have not yet heard any of those topics or you've missed one, please go back into the show, which is at tinyurl.com/CEM, as in customer experience management, so CEM hyphen show. And as you know, I'm with ClearActionCX.com consulting, and Ingrid is with ChiefCustomer.com. Ingrid's background is primarily in B2C, and mine's mostly in B2B, and we both have a lot of great resources on our blogs and websites. We encourage you to go there and also reach out to us on social media. Ingrid, today we're talking about customer lifetime value, so I think that a lot of people are probably curious about what the heck that is. They may have heard about it. They may have heard that it's something kind of complicated. How do you look at it?
Well, my favorite is, what acronym are they using to describe it, right? Is it CLV, MLV, PLV?
LTV.
Oh, my goodness, yes. Good one. Good one, Lynn. At the end of the day, so you know me, I'm like the ABCs, right? So it's got to be very simple and pretty direct here. And to me, lifetime value truly is the maximum amount of profit and or revenue you can get from a single person, because remember, I do all that B2C stuff, throughout the course of their relationship with you. And I think that it's something that most people don't pay that much attention to, or at least the way that they're thinking about it may not be all that, shall we say, sophisticated. How about you, Lynn?
Well, I agree with that, that it is definitely the cumulative value that you can derive over the course of your interactions or relationship duration with any entity, whether that be a business or whoever is in your revenue stream. And there is a lot of confusion about it. It's very underutilized, and it's a very high-powered topic that can propel your success in many ways in customer experience management. I think what slows people down from using customer lifetime value is the whole equation of figuring out profit, because you've got certain costs that are fixed and you have certain costs that are variable, and then assigning those in any degree of accuracy where your management audience is going to agree with your math there is the tricky part.
Oh, my goodness. I could not agree with you more. I think one of my absolute favorite parts of defining a CLV is having that moment. And you could have worked with every single person from finance. You could have every financial analyst walking into that CFO's office with you. And, you know, your COO, your CEO, your CMO, those are much easier conversations. But the one with my CFO always scares me the most, because that's that moment when you know that the likelihood of them agreeing with whatever math you did come up with is almost zero on the first pass. There have been so many times where I've walked in and I'm like, I swear, the math is good. I did it with your people, your chief of staff, your, you know, head of whatever it may be, your right hand, they agree. And without fail, every single time that CFO has looked at me and been like, well, I don't know if I think this is right. have you run into that, my friend?
Well, where I think that, you know, customer lifetime value gets some real credence and an urge. It's an urge for us to try to figure out how to get past these roadblocks of misunderstandings or arguments about the math, is there a common what do you call it, your knee-jerk reaction, or what comes to mind as making sense may not actually be true. So you usually would think that your highest revenue customers are the most profitable. but it's been proven that a lot of your highest revenue customers ask for a lot. They get good deals. They have volume discounts. They might, because of their size, require a lot of your resources. And so it's been proven, actually, that the largest customers are not necessarily your most profitable. And sometimes the smallest customers, you know, they could be more profitable, but they're small. And so a lot of times what you'll find is your mid-sized customers are a little bit less persnickety, and they do provide a good value. But you can't just go by any off-the-cuff rule for that. You actually need to look and see who are these people that are providing the largest bang for the buck. And I think what the real actionable element here in customer experience management is prioritizing your customer feedback, prioritizing your precious resources for deciding your innovations you want to create, the user experience improvements, and the customer experience snafus that you want to fix. It's also a very powerful tool in getting management's attention, because money talks.
For sure. And I think, you know, one of the things that I have found time and time again is that when you're sitting in, right, I've been an executive reporting to the CEO with a bunch of peers arguing about dollars, right? Who should get what portion of this bucket to do their pet projects? And as a customer experience officer, time and time again, you know, my first year, everyone's like, oh, yeah, give the money to Ingrid because, you know, she's here to fix all the broken stuff, right? That's about fail. The second year, I usually call this the pressure stage. That second and third year, that's when everybody's kind of like, okay, you've already got all the money, and why should we give you any more? And I found that employing a real customer lifetime value model and bringing that to the dialogue changes the entire conversation. Because to your point, Lynn, so many times I go into these companies and, you know, I was with an interesting B2B2C company. So they sold to a business, the business had employees, we were servicing both the business and those employees. So very convoluted relationship trying to figure out a true customer lifetime value model. And sure enough, we did find that the biggest customer at the employer client level, those weren't the most profitable. But what we were able to find was that the employees of those biggest customers were exceptionally profitable. So talk about really kind of throwing a bunch of confusion into the mix. It helped us, though, to be able to say, you know what, even though this is our biggest client, we know they're not profitable as an entity, but the long-term value we're going to be able to get out of their employees actually makes them more relevant to us. So it was a fascinating spin to be able to put on how do you make decisions, especially when you start to get into multiple constituencies, right? So prioritization, who gets the loudest voice at the table, and really just frankly changing the dialogue from here's what we've always thought to, well, here's what the numbers actually show us. That's always
yes.
A fun moment.
Well, I like to call that quantitative ROI and strategic ROI. So you need to pay attention to both, because quantitative ROI is where you just take the figures of costs and revenue per se and say, here's what we're getting out of the investment we're making. But in actuality, there's a lot more to it than just the dollars that are occurring in transactions. You have several resources that are being tapped to make stuff happen. So the denominator actually is bigger than just those dollars that you're seeing for a transaction. It's whatever resources are being in play. And then the numerator is not just the dollars that you're getting from those transactions. The numerator may be strategic value that you're getting from the relationship of being able to influence other potential or prospective customers or existing customers. It's also insights that you're getting for your innovations and so forth, just as you've mentioned, Ingrid. So how much have you pursued the strategic ROI path compared to the financial ROI path? Have you found any kind of balance there or a trigger for people to pay attention to both?
I love your use of terminology curious. On that. I always say there's the math and then there's my spidey sense. Yours sounds much better. So, you know, when I really think about it, my baseline has always been very much that traditional mathematically based ROI, right? So here's what we're actually going to get at a person-by-person level. It's a pretty clean path because in B2C, you know, we don't necessarily get the lift with, oh, we've got this great brand name, so they're going to be a little bit more valuable. Or, you know, I've seen that a ton in my B2B2C world, right? We won this client with this beautiful brand that'll be a great referral for other people in their sector. In the kind of B2C world, you don't see that nearly as much. But what you do start to see is we've started to finally pay attention to the power of that person. So lifetime value, right, generally built on a segmentation model, generally, you know, some pretty clear numerators and denominators that cut across large swaths of people. What I have seen and been a part of building is really being able to take things like influencer models and marrying that with that lifetime value model so that you can take it to an uncharted land that the math doesn't necessarily support, right? So it's the proverbial, here's the mom who's buying diapers and blogging about it, and she may only spend $1,000 a year with you, but her reach, she's got 100,000 followers, or there's 100,000 readers of her blog, or whatever it is. And so being able to extract and extend your lifetime value in those B2C models, that's, I think, where it gets really interesting and falls into spidey sense, a.k.a. strategic.
I agree. Now, the first time I came across the notion of customer lifetime value is from this very famous article in the Harvard Business Review by Reichelt and Sasser called Zero Defections, Quality Comes to Services. So Zero Defections, Quality Comes to Services. And this was a bit earth-shattering at the time, if you were in business in that era. They were showing how in various industries, the first year that someone's a member or a customer of your business is usually, it may be even a negative situation by transaction value and you know, how much it costs to serve them or to onboard them. However, year by year, if you're upselling and cross-selling and, you know, getting them to appreciate more of your whole product line, getting them to generate referrals. And so this is the genesis of a lot of what we're seeing now in customer experience management. Of course, what happened about 5 years later after this article came out was the emergence of customer relationship management software. And we see the upsell and cross-sell that is still nurturing. But I think that something that gets lost in the shuffle a lot with the way that we practice CRM or even loyalty management is looking at how the profitability, both costs and revenue, play into a natural segmentation of customers. So what I like to do with, say, voice of the customer data is see who likes certain things or who is unhappy about certain things, and then look and see what their revenue patterns are and what their cost patterns are, and do a rough and dirty quantification of those parts of the voice of the customer. So that's my favorite way of applying it. How about you, Ingrid?
Well, so, and I think you just touched on something that we should obviously always share. I think you and I always run into this, right? What's the easy way in? I think that there's so much theory out there about, well, here's how you should build the model and here's how you should do this, but it would take you, gosh, years and years to actually get a model that, you know, checked off every single one of those boxes. I love throwing up a bunch of data on the wall, really trying to just pull it apart. And it's the 80-20 rule at best, right? It's the 80-20 rule at best, because if you actually make some educated guesses based on profitability at a consumer level, you'll start to actually see some patterns that'll emerge pretty rapidly if you're right or wrong, correct? So it's that moment where you can say, okay, you know what, I made a bet on this group and we've invested a little bit more. We haven't actually seen anything change from how loyal they are, or how willing they are to promote or whatever it may be. We're not getting more share of wallet. We're not seeing a higher lifetime value and we are investing more. So let's go try that with this group. And I think the ability to do some really down and dirty, rough experiments, you know, I love starting little innovation labs where I have the ability to take those models and impact almost immediately a small group of humans just to see if it really does drive the behavior change we're after. So if you can connect what your lifetime value is to actually adding things into the actual experience that brings about a different behavior, that's when you know you've really hit the super spot, right? That's
yes.
The sweet spot.
That's right. I am a big fan of iterative, kind of an agile approach to customer lifetime value, because it's something that you can't just figure out in a week's time. It's not even something you can figure out in a quarter. And a lot of companies, I think, give assignments to people to say, you know, figure out all this ROI on our customer experience efforts or where we should be focusing. And I think that you can make some judgments initially, but there needs to be a constant iteration of refinements as you figure out a little bit more about what's actually happening, and then you bring that wisdom to bear, as well as a little bit more data access for the various costs, a meeting of the minds among the various managers and so forth. It's a whole change management endeavor that should take probably the course of several quarters, maybe even a few years of dedicated of effort. Not that you have to have full-time people on it, but an ongoing mindset of refinement.
For sure. And you have to have someone who actually has their finger on it. So I agree with you. It's not someone who it's their full-time role, but it is someone who's actually accountable for keeping it moving. That's something that I found time and time again is they build the model, they put the model up on the wall, and then the model is never edited, changed, adapted, even though the organization is constantly moving. And one of the things, this is an interesting real application that I have found to be exceptionally helpful. I try to take the impacts that we're making in the operation, right? So identifying when we make a change in the operation that we believe is going to have a significant impact on how that consumer feels about us. And I'll start to do the tracking between the operational change, the consumer sentiment, and then last but not least, what that does to value. And if you start to actually map that out over the course of, and once again, this isn't a, you know, 1 or 2 month gig, right? Over the course of 2, 3, 4 years, you can start to truly create those patterns and understand the levers you can pull back and forth to increase value at the right time, which then allows you to throttle organizational change into the right type of level setting. So you can't ask your organization to do everything at once, but it truly does once you understand operational change, what the impact is on your actual customer, and then what that impact is because of that customer on lifetime value. It is a heck of a business case. I have to tell you, it's pretty tough to argue all the way back to, it's hard to argue about the money, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, one of my favorite examples of a company doing something like that is Citrix with Tabitha Dunn. I interviewed her on this talk show. If you want to take a look at the archives in tinyurl.com/CEM-show, that's the show where we're recording right now. And the episode with Citrix tells you about a way that they looked at customer feedback from a various listening posts they had along the line of customers on a trial of their software, and as they also became customers, and then they gave feedback after that. So what they did was they applied customer lifetime value thinking to the feedback, and also worked with the engineers to get a common understanding of how to interpret that. And in so doing, they were able to create a model that guided their continual improvement of added features and you know, making a business case for all of the requests that came through either from engineers or customers. So they had a lot more solid way of making things happen. And I think it was an excellent success story.
So cool. I love seeing when people can actually figure it out. So I think more often than not, Lynn, so question for you that I'm going to throw out. What have you seen as the kind of biggest tripping point? I mean, I've shared about a couple of my clients where people have not necessarily been able to take that model and extend it. What's the biggest issue you've seen out there when it comes to building a true CLV model or using a CLV model?
Mm-hmm. Just putting too much emphasis on net promoter score for one thing. I think that that's one element, but there are a lot of other things that could be used as a source of value. So because of the notion that net promoter score is kind of the best indicator of whether a customer is really liking your brand and likely to involve other people in adding to your revenue stream and so forth, sometimes there's just tunnel vision on it. So I'd like to bring people's attention to a couple of resources that have opened up my eyes. For one thing, there's this book called Converting Customer Value. It has four authors, Murphy, Burton, Gleaves, and Krishoff. And this is by far the best resource I've found for customer lifetime value work, and they suggest that you start off with the quick and dirty. Like, for example, let's take a five-year period of revenue, and let's just look at our customers across the revenue stream for a certain amount of time. And then let's break that down, take that to the next level where we're maybe looking at what's the full relationship duration historically, and then taking it forward. Let's add in the cost next. For example, fixed costs. Let's just do that, or just variable costs, excuse me, and then migrating into a little bit more refinements of fixed costs over time. And they have a really good outline of the different types of costs and how to handle them, how to think about it, and how to do this as an iterative exercise that doesn't bite off too much at the beginning and allows you to build that buy-in among your various managers who really care about the math and refine this. So I think that it's a really great guide for the kinds of things that Ingrid's been talking about.
Love that book. Totally love that book. And I think, you know, one of the things that I found is that as long as you can look for some generally agreed upon levers within the business, right? So lifetime value, one of the things I've learned time and time again is if you build your lifetime value model wrapped around customer experience terms, things like, and I hate to say this, but things like loyalty and retention, and you start talking in that language, you lose half of your executive team. So finding that common language of how the business already talks about what success is and ensuring that the lifetime value model actually is in those terms has been, right, such an honest, just real trick that works, because then you're not introducing an entirely new language set to this group of people as well. So all sorts of wins and losses throughout time, right, Lynn?
There is, and I'd like to also call our listeners' attention to the fact that just like the overemphasis on Net Promoter, for example, is causing actually more consternation basically about this, and then people will just give up on the customer lifetime value because it's not getting them far enough. It's too tunnel vision. Here's what's really opened my eyes is this book by Timothy Kiningham. He was actually an MBA classmate of mine. We were in the same class at Vanderbilt University, and he's written several books, but this one called Loyalty Myths. This is going to rock your boat. These are myths that long-term customers purchase more. It's a myth that share of wallet increases as customer lifetime increases. It's a myth that loyal customers are less sensitive to price. So what he's done is he's looked at a lot of data with a team of people, and they're giving clarifications on some of these platitudes that we take for granted. yes, by and large, long-term customers buy more, but there's some caveats to that. And understanding those caveats will make you a lot wiser in the way that you approach customer experience management, and especially in the way that you're trying to apply customer lifetime value to bring bring more urgency and prioritization to the customer experience management goals that you have.
That's awesome. I love that. You love when you find something and you're like, this actually made me think differently.
Absolutely.
It made me push. Maybe that's a present that people should, who are listening, should go and put on all of their executive team's chairs tonight, right? Go purchase it from Amazon, have it delivered same day, gift it to everybody. I've always loved the platitude of, well, we know that they're going to spend more, or we know that they're more loyal to us. And I constantly find myself looking at these people and saying, but how do you know that? Do you know that because that's tribal knowledge, or do you know that because you've actually studied the behaviors of the people that are our customers? And 99% of the time, it is tribal knowledge, right? It's, well, somebody told me that when I started, and now I believe it to be true.
Yes, and I have to say that I'm a firm believer that, by and large, customer experience management and all the things that go with it make your business stronger, because it's logic, right? Who are we trying to please? What brings our salary? What brings our investors a return on their investment? Well, it's customers, right? And so the more that we can be aligned with our customers, it just makes sense that the more they're going to appreciate us and do more business with us. But when it comes down to allocating resources to serve customers in the right ways and to decide what to improve, decide what to introduce, it makes a lot of sense to add some scientific element to it, and customer lifetime value is a way of doing that.
It definitely takes the emotion out of the conversation once you've all agreed that it's the right equation, right? Takes the emotion out of the conversation once everyone has agreed that it's the right equation. And I think that in and of itself, if you can get to that point where you have a common definition, a common language, and then allow that to become a part of how you prioritize, how you actually hand out budgets, how you make decisions about who you're going to build what for, that's where the magic truly is, right? That's when it becomes not necessarily who's loudest or who has the best story today or who's done the most work in the hallways to get the most support for their project. It really does become all about what is actually going to add to the bottom line for our company. And that's why I love it. That's why I love the models, and that's why I build them pretty quickly whenever I arrive somewhere.
So I'd like to just add a twist to what you said is, I think that it takes the subjectivity out of all those decisions to be more objective, but I think it adds emotion that is constructive for customer experience management. Because when you say, this is my recommendation for where to start, you're getting customer feedback from whatever sources. Do a little bit of research about that group of customers that are wanting such and such feature, or wanting, you know, such and such thing to go away, and just find out what is their cumulative revenue, and then tell your managers when you're reporting out, instead of just saying, hey, we got a 7 on a scale of 10, or we got whatever percentage of, move it into a percentage. So say that 40% of customers said this. Okay, normally your executives are going to say, okay, only 40%. Well, 60% don't. So I'm just going to go about business as usual. We'll take that 40% and say, this represents, you know, such and such $1 million of our business. And there you're taking now your voice of the customer and making it more meaningful, like they're saying, but this is the amount of dollars that are at risk or at in play for me to make change happen. And so I would suggest something as simple as that as a beginning point. Any parting words of wisdom from you, Ingrid?
Oh, love it, Lynn. I think the best trick I've got up my sleeve to close with is, one of my favorite things to do is to walk into a room and put up the number of people who've left and the dollar impact that has on the bottom line. And that's usually where I start the conversation, because it does get everybody aligned pretty rapidly, doesn't it?
It does. Well, I want to thank all of our listeners today. We really appreciate the opportunity to share our ideas with you. And if you'd like to see more, please go to our respective websites. That's chiefcustomer.com for Ingrid Lundberg and clearactioncx.com for myself. We've got a lot of related information there that we would love for you to take a look at, and certainly reach out to us on social media. Ingrid, what are your social media handles?
I'm at IC Lundberg on Twitter, best place to find me.
IC Lundberg, and I'm at Clear Action on Twitter. Okay, everyone, please stay tuned for our next online conversation coming up in just a couple of weeks here. Thanks so much, and best wishes to you in optimizing customer experience.